Broadcasting from the Business Radio X studio in Orlando, Florida, it's time for Regions Business Radio Orlando. Regions Business Radio Orlando is presented by Regions Bank. Brave the beginning. Member FDIC.
Welcome to Regions Business Radio Orlando, presented by Regions Bank, member FDIC, and an equal housing lender. I'm your host, Scott Wall, and I'm a commercial banking leader with Regions Bank here in our Central Florida market. We are broadcasting live from the Business Radio X studio in downtown Orlando, Florida today. And my guests are Dr. Brian Ray, who is the director at the Poe Business Ethics Center at the Warrington College of Business at the University of Florida, and Dr. Ron Piccolo, who's the Associate Dean for Strategic Initiatives at the College of Business at the University of Central Florida. Hey, fellas, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Scott.
Great to be here, Scott. Thank you.
Let's start with brief introductions. Ron, how about you start us off?
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I appreciate it. I've been in Central Florida for a long time. I came to Stetson University out in DeLand. I was a math major. Met my wife and have been here ever since. Went to Rollins College, the Crummer Graduate School, for an MBA. And then found myself in Gainesville at the University of Florida. Got a PhD in Business Administration, Organizational Behavior and Leadership. And then I joined UCF as a faculty member in 2005. I was there for 4 years. And then went back to Rollins on the faculty at Crummer from 2009 to 2016, and then back to UCF again, and I've been there ever since. And so my experience at UCF has been primarily in the classroom, teaching courses in leadership and strategy, organizational behavior, and research methods. But I've also had several different administrative roles, including department chair and now associate dean in the college.
Hey, Brian, how about your background? A little different.
You know, my passion's always been working with bright, motivated young people. Studied finance at Stetson, have an MBA from UCF, but halfway through that experience, realized I want to be with bright, motivated young people. That took me to Florida State, where I got my PhD in university administration, and I've always worked with young people, particularly ones who are bright and passionate and want to find a really interesting path in life. I was the associate dean at the College of Business at UF for 17 years. Really liked to focus on getting students to experience life outside the classroom. Study abroad is really important. All the experiential education, internships, and so forth. The other thing I've done in my life besides work with college students would be my time in the military. I did ROTC at Stetson and just retired after 35 years in the Army Reserve, having gone to Iraq and Afghanistan. And my last assignment was actually at the Pentagon as a chaplain and teacher of ethics and leadership at the Joint Staff. So if it's ethics and leadership, that's what I love to talk about.
Wow, fellas. I mean, some serious careers there. Thank you. Well, let's get into it. And really today, gentlemen, I wanted, you know, think about maybe our listeners. I'm thinking we've got perhaps young entrepreneurs, we've got business owners, folks that might be professionals thinking about doing business with other firms. I'd love to talk about some of your studies. I mean, you both have pretty extensive careers on the education side with leadership. And Ron, let me start with you. I read an article that you had co-published back in 2023, last year, and it was about critical thinking. I mean, that's pretty important. But maybe share some views on that, and again, from the lens of a potential business owner.
So, you know, what's the purpose of education or what's the purpose of college? You'll hear this over and over again, and you hear it especially from the liberal arts or from degrees that don't immediately translate into a career, whatever they may be, right? There's always criticisms about certain majors, if you will. And the justification for all of those experiences is to develop critical thinking. That's what we aspire for. That's what the education is for. And so when I started to write a textbook in organizational behavior, developing critical thinking was sort of core to what we were trying to propose. But it became very clear that not everybody agreed on what that was. Like, what does it mean to think critically? It's nice to say, everybody wants it, but not everybody knows exactly what it is. So the purpose of the article was to lay out a specific way that people can develop their critical thinking skills, try to define what it is clearly and tactically and practically, how to develop questions that are in pursuit of common critical thinking standards. And so, you know, my experience with it has been that it's very useful. I actually did a workshop on it last week with a local company, and it's sort of like, you know, creating a specific playbook that managers and problem solvers can use to try and be more clear, more precise, more accurate in their analyses. And so, not to get lost in the original question, the purpose of education is to develop critical thinking, and the purpose of that article was to show how it can come to life in a practical way.
You can be a better critical thinker, right? One can learn how to be better at critical thinking, which would impact positively, I would think, most domains in life.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there, you know, again, it's one of those things where, are you thinking critically? You know, what specifically does that mean? It's definitely a skill that you can learn. It's a muscle that you can strengthen. You can learn to do specific things, how to address problems, how to unpack concepts, how to think in a way that limits the risk of bias, limits the risk of your own self-interest, if you will. And of course, I think it's so important in every relationship and every time you're dealing with a problem. Any business owner, any entrepreneur, any manager is trying to solve problems, trying to develop business, trying to figure out what their clients or customers really need. You know, having the discipline or the thought or the willingness, or for that matter, the humility, right, to ask additional questions and to challenge your own assumptions. There's just so many ways that translates into good outcomes.
Yep, and I know you. There was mention of there of ethics too. And Brian, we're going to come back to ethics here in a moment. Strategy. I mean, that's important. That's something that many of our clients talk about, trying to improve upon, right? Mid to long term strategies. Is that a part of your studies and your teachings at school?
Well, Scott, I'd recommend people actually go out and Google something called the MDMP. It's the military decision-making process. I mean, every military officer is taught about this concept, and the concept begins with what's your mission? What are you trying to accomplish? And once you've defined the mission, hopefully you have clearly defined a mission that's achievable, you go into some fact analysis and some course of action development, and then you find a way to make sure you very clearly and succinctly compare various courses of action. And I'm glad that Ram was talking about bias, because a lot of times folks want their top course of action to be the one that they want to choose. But I think it's really good to bring some people from the outside and really look at the course of action development. And if they Google MDMP, they're going to find a very clear way to do course of action development, course of action analysis, to hopefully find the right approach to solve the big problem they're trying to deal with.
That's process driven, right?
Yes.
That's what you're explaining?
Yes.
Yeah. And back, Ron, before I ask you about that article that I made mention earlier, what was neat is there is this, you and your co-authors write about this approach where you're trying to be maybe neutral and really trying to look at both sides. I mean, I'm looking at the last page of the article. It was point counterpoint, right? And I think the point you were trying to make was not any one statement is correct. I'll tell our audience a couple of examples, but the point is look before you leap, and the counterpoint is he who hesitates is lost, right? These are very different. One more is you can't teach an old dog new tricks, and then it's never too late to learn. So anyway, back to your comments about rethinking and a process for critical thinking strategy. I wish more of us, including myself, slowed down to do that more. So I don't know, Ron, on your end, on the strategy side.
I think whether it's strategy, whether it's critical thinking, whether it's ethical thinking, I mean, fundamentally, it's a discipline in how you process information. It's a discipline in how you imagine and analyze concepts, right? And undisciplined thought is where it leads to bias or exaggerated conclusions, etc. And so the article is to introduce paradoxical proverbs. Like, for every little token of wisdom, there's often wisdom that's exactly opposite of that. And so we can all be convinced, right, with some wonderful expressions, don't sweat the small stuff. But then someone else might say the devil's in the details. So it's like, well, which one are we doing here? Which one is it? And so I think in the case where there's value in the critical thinking and the discipline in the thought and avoiding bias, particularly with mission, is like, if there's a problem, and I'm sure that your listeners have had this problem at the company and can't figure out what we're going to do. Sales are struggling, or, you know, business is slow. Well, if you ask the marketing folks, they'll tell you they need more resources in marketing. It's a marketing issue. And if you ask the folks in, you know, product development, they'll say, oh, it's a design issue. We need more resources in design. And if you ask the finance people, it's like, we need access to credit or capital. And so very often people bring their own preferences, their own biases, their own self-serving interest you know, to solving a problem. And so the critical minds, or those who are intentional and strategic in how they approach problems, you know, minimize the impact of the natural biases that people bring.
Fortune 500 companies spend millions of dollars trying to teach middle managers these domains, how to be a better critical thinker, right? Strategy. I mean, I'm on a board of directors and strategy is very important for us. So these topics are being teased out all the time, both in your classes and in big companies. They're important. I guess that's where I'm landing here. They're very important.
Mm-hmm. But it's not easy to do. And in a lot of cases, like with companies, right, quarterly earnings, short-term objectives, you know, the whims and preferences of a leader or a board, to your point, like a lot of times the systems and the structures and the processes and the demands don't really support, you know, a thoughtful, intentional, critical thinking process. It's like we have to be able to react quickly. And sometimes, you know, why doesn't critical thinking happen more often? One, people don't know what it is and don't know how to do it. Number two, you know, they're just not good at it, or they are lazy. And another thing is, like, there's a lot of forces against, right, deep, critical, cynical approach to problem solving. And so there's a lot of headwinds, right, that hold people back from being intentional about strategy, ethics, and, you know, other, you know, critical problem solving. I'm sure that, Brian, that's the case with, you know, ethical thinking all the time.
Well, I think a good critical thinker also is going to know when someone's trying to build a narrative as opposed to build a strategy. So I'll give you an example for journalism. Quite often we'll read stories that say because of A and B, we should do X. And then you read a different article that says, well, because of C and D, we should do Y. But see, both authors chose to omit either C or D or A or B. And if you had somebody write an article, well, based upon A, B, C, and D, we should actually do Z. And I find that's quite a big challenge that we have in just clear-eyed strategic decision-making, is somebody wanting to not bring all the important information to the table for the decider. And the decider has to be very nuanced to understand when he or she's not being given the full story. In the military, for example, we always say the enemy gets a vote. And there's somebody in that strategic decision-making MDMP process who is the enemy and is saying, I'm going to do X, now what? And I think often in business, we don't analyze very, very well what's the most likely unfortunate event or what's the most catastrophic unfortunate event, and have we planned accordingly for both?
The stakes are high, obviously, in the military.
Sure.
Yeah. And I'm not necessarily asking either of you to have an opinion on this, but, you know, Brian, when you speak about that metaphor, having the facts, having information, you know, social media is not always correct, right? I mean, that's a thing now. And so particularly as we go into a political season, and we're not going to get into politics today, obviously, but people get their information online now, right? I mean, through social media. And I guess the question embedded here is that a dynamic that people have to be very much aware of with respect to making decisions based on what they read and what may or may not be true?
What scares me, not about politics, but just about the fact that we just keep getting information that reinforces our particular points of view, right? So we continually get confirmation bias of what we already believe. And it's pervasive, and it's scary because you never get to see an alternative, right? You have to be intentional and proactive and humble enough to, like, seek out information that is inconsistent with your existing belief. I mean, that's hard to do. None of us have time to do it. That's the thing that worries me more than anything else. Whether it's your Twitter feed or your whatever you're looking at to get your news, it just reinforces the point of view. Whatever you've clicked or liked or watched, you just get more of it. And very often it just completely dismisses or discounts whatever alternative, or even to Brian's point, a nuanced interpretation of what you're getting is just not available to you. So, you know, I kind of encourage our students as a pep talk, you know, when we're working through it, like critical thinking as a course, I'm like, we have to be great critical thinkers because most of the world is not. And so this sort of, we sort of have to assume the responsibility of trying our very best, as challenging as it is, to be careful and thoughtful and willing to see the other side.
General Patton said, if everybody in the room is thinking the same way, nobody's thinking. And that was a way for him to push his staff to not provide him with the course of action that they thought he wanted to hear. I think also another way to describe bias for your listeners is if you're really good with a hammer, everything appears to be a nail. And so if you got a bunch of folks who love using the hammer, again, you're not going to have that what I call blind spot or the folks who want to ignore potential black swan events. And I think that's what happens. I mean, think about 07, 08. I mean, somebody's going to get caught with that hot potato, which is a financial asset that's really worthless. And there's only so many chairs and musical chairs. But that's a leader's decision to decide that we're not going to go down that path.
Yeah.
I guess on critical thinking, more of a long-range perspective is also valuable for folks to think about. I think we don't celebrate incremental wins enough in the field of education or even business. And celebrating those, the journey, if you will, as a way to kind of keep people on the straight and narrow, if you will, as opposed to always swing for the fences. Home runs or strikeouts, you can play that baseball game all day long.
Yep.
But get a bunch of hits and a bunch of doubles, you're probably going to win the game.
Yeah, and I'm thinking when there's personalities involved, back to your patent example, Brian, you know, really what you're describing with critical thinking strategy, and we'll come to ethics shortly, it's about finding the truth, right? And I'm not sure all teams want to find the truth in business and beyond, but that's what I think, that's the whole point of this, is to find the absolute best case scenario for whatever we're talking or selling. Let me transition, guys, to another topic that's related inherently to critical thinking and strategy would be business ethics. And Brian, it's something I know you've made a career both in education and the military, living, breathing, and studying. And I will say, you know, the book that you gave Ron and I, where you suggested we read, which I did read, The Business Ethics Field Guide, was really fascinating and had some incredible real life examples of ethical dilemmas. So maybe speak about that. How do you teach that in the classroom? How important is it? And of course, feel free to cite any examples from this book.
Sure. Well, Scott, the one I would tell your listeners to think about is I tell folks I don't teach ethics. I teach ethical decision making. It's a skill. When folks hear ethics, they probably think of philosophy. But I also think it's funny when people will say, you know, Brian, I'm so glad you teach ethical decision making. We need so much more of that. Look at all the embezzling and the cheating and the deceit. And I say, that's not ethics. That's called right and wrong. That's why I describe ethical dilemmas as the best way to describe what I teach. There's something called rationalizations. These are things that we tell ourselves to make ourselves feel better about making a suboptimal ethical decision. So once you wash away all the rationalizations, you'll find quite often it's not an ethical dilemma at all. It's a right or a wrong. I'll give you an example of rationalizations. Everybody does it this way. Who's really going to get hurt? We're just going to bend the rules a little bit. So we cook the books every now and then. All those are rationalizations that when you wash those all away, it's a right-wrong decision. So an ethical dilemma is when you have two wrongs or two rights, or more specifically when you have stakeholders who both have very important interests, and those interests are typically in tension. So I'm glad you mentioned the Business Ethics Field Guide. If anybody just, I'm promising you, it's probably the best 20 or 25 bucks you're ever going to spend. It's a way to provide insurance for your business. And it's not so much does the business owner or does the key leader in the business understand ethical decision making. The real question is, on a scale of 1 to 10, you can give yourself a 9 on ethical decision making, but what do you give for your staff? Because if your staff's at a 5 or 6, that's where your real risk is. I kind of found this out at the Pentagon. I had to pretend the generals were all ethical. And I said, so ladies, so gentlemen, you know ethical decision making. I'm going to teach you some things so you can go to your staff and protect your unit or protect your division, if you will. But in that book, what the authors did is they put together a compilation of 500 different case studies and analyzed those. And some student asked the lead author, how many different kinds of ethical dilemmas are there? Now, when I first heard that idea, Scott, my Army brain thought 13 battle drills. But then for any sports analogy, can we teach ourselves to run 13 different plays? Sure we can. And so it's actually very empowering when you think about the fact that there are only 13 distinct ethical dilemmas. So you can actually work with your team, work with your staff, and maybe once every other week, let's talk about each of these 13 different ethical dilemmas that we'll confront. Because to be really, I'd say, effective at going through each of those different 13 ethical dilemmas, I say you're going to build the three C's over time. The first one is competence. We should all want to be competent in understanding the 13 different ethical dilemmas. After competence, you have confidence. You want your team to be confident and actually run toward the ethical dilemma. You don't want them to run away from it. And that's the third C, which is courage. So I'll kind of end with this first thought. When I first teach this class, I ask my students, raise your hand if you're excited about the next ethical dilemma you're going to confront. None of the hands go up. And I said, this is the exact opposite we need. I said, once you develop competence and confidence and courage, you can't wait for the next ethical dilemma to come your way, because you can then show your colleagues and your boss what you're made of. The spotlight's on you when ethical dilemmas come your way. And so for all the listeners, ask yourself, do you want the next dilemma to come your way? The answer has to be yes, because that's when you show not just your colleagues, but your customers what you're made of.
Well, and you will, you know, reading this book, and I might, Brian, just ask you to give a quick example of one of the 13, but I recognize a handful of these immediately. I mean, we're all going to come across these in our everyday life, both in business, in life, every domain. And so it was pretty expansive, and it was, I thought it was a really interesting read, gave me some perspective. I got some work to do to build those three C's, but I'll work on it. But even, you know, I've been in business in banking 27 years. I'm still learning this stuff. This book was worth the read. So maybe what would be an example of one that is pretty pervasive?
Well, I'll offer this as a thought first, the idea of your antenna being up and on. Okay, if you don't know there are 13 ethical dilemmas, you won't be able to identify which one you're in. But it's interesting, in the class I teach, after about the first month, students will say, Dr. Ray, I see ethical dilemmas every week. Oh my goodness, they're everywhere. I'm like, yeah, they are, but you didn't know that. And that's part of the idea about being aware that you're in one, because chances are your colleague and your boss actually know you are facing a dilemma. And that's a horrible situation to be in when you actually don't know that you are. But of the 13, a couple common ones I think most folks would understand, the first would be stamp to power. That's where either your boss or a customer is asking you to do something that really is not the right thing to do. It's against the organization's values. Another example would be made a promise and the world has changed. So one of the case studies in that book is a young woman who agreed to do a 6-month internship, and about a month in, another company offered her another job, a full-time job, paying $20,000 more than this 6-month internship. Well, what does she do? She made that commitment to the company for 6 months. She's only a month in. Ironically enough, it was the consulting firm that actually this nonprofit hired who tried to hire her away from the nonprofit. Well, that's a conflict of interest. That's dilemma number four. And so quite often, these dilemmas actually overlap quite a bit. Another example would be sacrificing personal values. You agreed to come work for a company. They promised you wouldn't have to work on Sundays. Well, all of a sudden, they're going back on that promise. How much of your values are you willing to sacrifice in that regard? And the last one I'll mention is this. The last one's called showing mercy, which, to be blunt, is like you have a person in the organization who violated the values of the organization. How much mercy do you show? Is this a forgivable offense? Well, once you make that decision with that one individual, that's now the bar. That's where the bar is set for the organization. So I promise you, if your readers grab this book, they've seen these 13 dilemmas in some way, shape, or form. I tell folks, we've all seen these movies, but guess what? You're now the actor or the actress in the movie. And really important to know if the film's rolling. And to be confident and be courageous.
Yeah.
Because I tell people there's nothing more inspiring than to see somebody who's showing courage in the face of an ethical dilemma.
That's great stuff. And for sure, that was a really interesting read. I have a question for both of you. This is an easy one. We have a client and meeting with him recently. And this gentleman has been in his industry for 50 years. And he's been really successful. And I asked him, we were at a dinner function, and I said, hey, what would be two pillars in your last 50 years that you hold the most dearly? And he said, thought about it for a couple seconds, and he came with, this one won't surprise you, work hard, right? And the second one was treat people fairly and with respect. That is operating with ethics. Like, it was such a simple response, but it was such a cool thing to hear after such a long career. So it made me think about that book. On that note, I've got some questions for you too. As we wrap up here. The first is, and think about your students and your classes, What's some advice you're giving your students now in real time around starting in the workforce?
I offer this sort of guidance, advice, challenge when we have new students, particularly in our graduate programs. This is not related to critical thinking. The advice is to spend $5 a week. And so find a time during the week, Friday morning, whatever, and take somebody for coffee, someone you're interested in knowing or someone who's in your business or someone that you admire or someone you'd like to know, et cetera. And just buy them coffee and listen and ask them about how they got to where they are, how they made some decisions to move perhaps from one job to another or one career to another, or how they dealt with a conflict or whatever. And just do that every week, right, while they're in school. And you can even ask people at the end of the meeting, like, are there other people that I should meet or other people that I should know, et cetera. And, the encouragement that I will have, particularly for students who are in like a one-year program or, they're looking for a new job or changing careers, it's like, well, if you do that every week, you suddenly have like 35 new people that you've just spent some time with who can open up doors or give you guidance or whatever. So that's my advice. $5 a week won't take much. And then that's how you broaden your network.
And you're going to get a great return on your investment.
Yep.
I promise you. Hey, Brian, what about you?
I'm going to pick up right where he mentioned. I mean, I'll use the Pink Floyd lyric from Dark Side of the Moon. All you touch and all you see is all your life will ever be. And the three courses I teach, one in career management, one in leadership, and one in ethics, in every course I teach, you have to go out and actually interview 5 people. So for the career course, interview 5 people who have jobs you think you want one day, or the folks who hire for the job you want one day. For my leadership course, go interview 5 people you think are very strong leaders. Ethics course, go interview 5 people you think who've dealt with difficult ethical dilemmas and just kind of pick their brain. I got this idea really because I think I tell people if you really want to do X or do Y, you have to go talk to the people who do those activities, folks who actually sit in the chair. Because when you have those discussions like Ron's talking about, you're going to realize there's more than just one or two paths to get where you want to go. And the biggest enemy of any decider is you don't know what you don't know. And talking to these folks who have seen the movie before can be very, very insightful. The other piece of advice I usually offer to students or anybody would be when you first go in and have that first sit down with your new supervisor, ask them, who's the best X you've ever had? So who's the best intern you ever had and why? Who's the best entry-level employee you've ever had and why? Once again, when you ask that question, you're pretty much subliminally telling that person, I want to be the best you've ever had. And that really raises the bar for the expectations on the part of your new supervisor, but also yourself. But then when they mention who this best person who's done X is, guess what your next step is? Go have coffee with that person. Find out where they are. Because that person's made a positive impact. They've made their mark in an organization, or at least with the supervisor.
It just makes me think of, lean in, right? And be present, I mean, in simple terms. And I think that's really great, both of them.
Yeah. And Scott, with LinkedIn and Zoom, it's so much easier now.
For sure.
Yeah.
But look, talking face-to-face is not a lost art. Okay. I mean, quite the opposite.
Let me add one thing, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
So my secondary advice after having coffee is send a note, a handwritten note, to the person you met with. Not a text message, not a message on LinkedIn, like write them a note. And I laugh because for the longest time I had a yellow post-it note on my door. And it said, Dr. Pickle, thank you for, your impact on my career. And so when other students would come in, I say, go spend $5 a week and then write a handwritten note. I'm like, and that's not like the post-it note on the door is not what I'm talking about, because literally I suggested this to a student. And the next day at my office was a post-it note on my door. I'm like, no, that's not what I meant. I meant like you write out a note and send it, with a stamp. Like there's still ways to actually use the U.S. Postal Service, and let's do it.
Yeah, that's awesome. I learned that lesson from my mom and my grandmother, and I'm a huge fan of the thank you note handwritten. So, hey, gentlemen, first off, Brian, if you would have told me that Pink Floyd would be discussed on this podcast, I would have been surprised, coming from you. So well played. I love that song and that album. As we wrap up a couple more minutes, just a couple more questions. For your careers, what is something that you are both most proud of? Brian, I'll start with you.
I guess what brings me a lot of pride is just to see where my former students are now, or my former soldiers. I loved being an Army chaplain. It was great to help young people and help soldiers. But I really enjoyed more, Scott, being a senior chaplain. When I was responsible for 7 to 10, you know, mid-grade chaplains and trying to help them figure out where they wanted to go. So I just like to find people and help them grow and develop and go where they want. Quite often you need, I won't call it a mentor, I think it's an overused word, you need somebody who's going to push you out of your stagnation zone. I hate the phrase comfort zone. It's not really what it is. It's a stagnation zone. And so to have that strong inner circle of people who will push you out of your stagnation zone and say, I know you got this. You're going to stumble a little bit, but just let's make this happen. And so I've just really enjoyed helping people grow and develop. It's been a joy.
Great. Thanks, Brian. Hey, Ron.
Yeah, I think I would echo that. I mean, watching students blossom is very rewarding. Although I will say, recency bias, something that I'm really proud of, not necessarily related to the career in education, is just having been given a couple of really thorny problems to address, you know, with the university and with some of our community partners, where the temperatures were high and there was a lot of uncertainty and a lot at stake and a lot of tension, and sort of being put in the middle of that and trying to sort of get people, I won't even say on the same page, just like in the same book, and untangle some really tight knots. I've done that a couple times in the last few years, and it's been a stretch, and I've grown a lot as a result of it, and you know, good outcomes all the way so far, knock wood. I'm sort of proud of those experiences.
Got it. Well, I just, as we close here, gentlemen, I want to first thank you for coming on the show, of course. But, I mean, students are fortunate and lucky to have both of you in the classroom. You're doing some really important work, both of you, and have for many, many years. I appreciate that. I appreciate the friendships. And once again, it's really a real treat to have you both on today. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
I'd like to thank our guests, and I want to thank our listeners to Regions Business Radio Orlando, presented by Regions Bank, member FDIC, and an equal housing lender. You can enjoy our episodes anytime by visiting businessradiox.com and selecting the Orlando studio and then clicking on Regions Business Radio. This program is also available on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you enjoy your favorite podcasts. Please be sure to subscribe to the program so that you don't miss any of our future episodes. I'm Scott Wall, and you've been listening to Regions Business Radio Orlando on Business Radio X.
Regions Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. This information is general in nature and is not intended to be accounting, legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Regions believes this information to be accurate when recorded, but it cannot ensure that it will remain up to date. Consult an appropriate professional concerning your specific situation. The information should not be construed as a recommendation of a specific course of action for any individual or business. All Regions products and services are subject to qualification requirements, terms, conditions, fees, and credit approval. Regions reminds its customers that they should be vigilant about fraud and security, and that they are responsible for taking action to protect their computer systems. Fraud prevention requires a continuous review of your policies and practices as the threat evolves daily. There is no guarantee that all fraudulent transactions will be prevented or that related financial losses will not occur. Visit regions.com/stopfraud or speak with your banker for further information on how you can prevent fraud.